Inside Tech World for September 2011 is almost on the air. At this point, people either think we have the greatest intro of all time or are like, what's this really hard rock? We're technical writers. This is supposed to be calm. Regardless, welcome to Inside Tech World for September. My name's Al Martine. And this is our show. This is our first podcast for Tech World. We're going to be looking at changing UIs. And we've got a few people in with us today. We have Jackie Samuels and Craig Cardiman. How are you guys doing today?
Very good, awesome. Thank you.
And last but not least, the editor of Tech World's Tech Writer Today magazine, Connie Giordano. Welcome, Captain.
Also known as Chief Cat Herder.
Yes, cat herding, writing the occasional article, podcasting star now, a little bit of everything. We are a small but a mighty group of communicators here at Tech World. Today's show's on documenting a changing user interface and how you as technical writers or communicators can kind of keep up or at least inject yourself into the process. These are going to be articles that are going to come out on Tech World this week before and after the show is finally published. Our aim is to give you some good ideas that can make you more effective in whatever job you may be doing. Before we get into it, we do want to say a word of thanks and to let everyone know that this show, as well as our tips and tricks column, is sponsored by Adobe Systems. If you want to download a free 30-day free trial of Adobe FrameMaker, go to their website, adobe.com, or click on their ad on our website to download your free trial. But before we get into the heart of the show, the reason tens of you have clicked in, let's learn about our contestants. Jackie Samuels. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, your work background, any shameless plugs you have for companies you may own, and your favorite key on the keyboard.
All right, then. I'm from Toronto, Canada. I'm living in Ottawa right now. I've spent the last 7 years as a tech writer, six of those as a writer at a high-performance computing software company in Toronto, documenting basically all of their products in those 6 years. They kept moving me around. And we had a team of about 8 writers, 1 translator, My dev teams were from anywhere from six guys, basically, to I had one large team of about 22 dev, and they were international, so quite large teams. Ended up documenting at least two different UIs. But the interesting part about that job was we went from running books and chapters, so the old way, to writing data topics using a CMS. So I got the whole, I got datafied very early on in my career. So I turned that into a consulting gig. My company is WritingWise, and I also consult for Publishing Smarter. And that's what I do now. Favorite key on the keyboard would have to be the Q, because it's just kind of sticking out there wanting you to press it.
All right. All right. And Craig Cardaman.
Yes, sir.
Same as Jackie, but which pen color? Blue or black ink? Which one? If you're gonna go for the pen color, which one?
Black.
Black.
Always
okay.
Black.
And then a little bit about.
Let's see. I reside in Pennsylvania, and that's where I'm from. I'm the lone technical writer for MSG, which is a small software company in Fort Washington. I've been doing technical writing since 2006 as part of my job title. And I use Madcap Flare to prepare our user guides. I'm the first and only tech writer. So I'm very interested when people talk about being part of teams, because as far as the writing goes, I'm basically the team as far as the user guides and stuff like that. So that kind of thing is very interesting to me, because normally it's pretty much just me. And on the side, I try to run a bit here and there on the weekends. And we also, my wife and I volunteer at the local writers group. Try to coordinate
Ooh, fiction.
That too. Yes.
Nice.
So that's kind of it for me, I guess.
So help me with the writers group thing, because I went a totally different place until I heard fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, hi, my name's Al. Hi, Al. What are you guys doing in the writing?
You're not an AA group, Al.
you're allowed to do whatever you want to do. Some people write poetry. Some people exorcise family demons by writing about said family demons.
Ooh, therapy.
Exactly. And some of us are wannabe horror fiction writers. So some of us go into, what happens when the local Red Cross blood drive takes more than just your blood.
I think that's you, Craig.
Exactly. Wow. So, yeah, I can get pretty gory sometimes.
Gotcha. And we have the Halloween Horrors thing coming up next month, so we're going to have some good material here. And Connie and I, matter of fact, Jackie, you're like, so Connie and I actually really got to know each other working on a Halloween themed a haunted house, right? So with the JCs back in Charlotte. So Jackie, follow-up question. So, you know, knives or poison, if you're going to whack somebody, how would you do it? You know?
Well, if you don't want to be caught, you got to go poison, right?
Fair enough. So, and then finally, Connie, background, roles today. And if you've ever found any images in pieces of toast, say with butter, or if it come out, I didn't share all the questions here.
I have not checked eBay lately to see if my picture of William Shatner as Captain Kirk has sold. But anyway, I've been in and around tech world for a long, long, long time. I started posting back in the end of 1998. So I'm one of those ancient tech writers who remembers Windows 3.1 with some fondness, actually. I, at this point in my career, I have several roles. I am currently on a contract handling change management communications for one of the several really large financial institutions that have major offices in the Charlotte, North Carolina area. And you can then decide which one that might be. And I also have my own consulting company that where I do website design, knowledge management consulting, and various kinds of marketing communications called The Right Words. And then Al and I are the managing partners for Inktopia, which manages Tech World, the Tech Writer Today magazine online, and the world famous mail email listserv for discussing all things technical writing related, and sometimes things that are not technical writing related, which is where the whole cat herder thing comes in, by the way. So anyway, I have never found, as far as I know, I have never found images of any kind of paranormal activity in my buttered toast.
Fair enough, fair enough. And it didn't have to be paranoid. It could have been like, well, that's where we got our last UI for techworld.com. There's a bunch of people going, that explains it. Oh.
Exactly.
And just to introduce myself a little bit, my name's Al Martin. I'm the head of janitorial services at Tech World. I am a pretty much cover everything. Helping out with just about everything that isn't editorial related, from cleaning up various CSS files to being able to unscrew our Google rankings. If you found us, congratulations. We like to make it as hard as possible for anyone to actually find our website, and I'm the one who's primarily responsible for that at this moment.
We're so proud.
And that's about it. So this is the crew that's with us today, and we're going to be talking about the UI that let's say the one that we found in Connie's buttered toast that has changed from the beginning. So I guess the biggest, I'll start the question. I think Connie's going to jump in, so if we think of some questions in this beginning, we're just sort of fleshing out some ideas. But this first question, and we'll go with Craig on this one, since nobody can see each other on this, is any big gotchas in your career for changing UI where you released the report and then found out something that is different than you thought it was going
to
be?
I think the biggest gotcha would have to be thinking you've got it nailed and that it's not going to change, because it simply always does change. A client is always requesting changes, modifications, edits, and they're usually being made. But you're not always in the loop. So just when you think, okay, I've got this thing documented, it's done, it's in the can, out the door, then the next time you look at it, it's different. And you're the one on the spot. You have to make sure that, that you're on top of things, because your boss is not always going to tell you, and neither are the programmers always going to tell you. It does change.
It is, in fact, of life that it always changes. I think some of the more interesting gotchas I've had have included when working with a fairly sizable development team, only 2% of whom had English as their native language, and getting an idea of what that UI was going to look like, and then when I saw it in production, having to go back and suggest that they change the abbreviation for association.
Classic. Gotta have that O and that C, or else it's just bad.
Was it true, though? I mean, was the acronym really more true than you thought? You don't have to name names.
Well, this was in the very, very ancient days of doing mortgage processing software, so you can kind of make your own judgment on that.
Well, my biggest gotcha was working on a project where the UI was changing every day, basically. And that was not just every day during development, but past the alpha, past the beta dates. We're getting up to code freeze. They keep moving code freeze out, by a couple of days here and there. So constantly changing UI. And it wasn't hard to keep up with the constantly changing UI. Update the document. You can update it as fast as they can make the changes, basically, as long as you have something to look at. But I got the worst upon retrospect now, the worst tunnel vision. I ended up documenting the functionality rather than the user goals, and that made the documentation in the end fairly redundant and not that useful for the user. So if I'd had a focus on the user's goals instead of the features and the functionality they were creating, it would have been much better.
Interesting. So if you were going to, in your experience and in the environments that you deal with now, how do you define what does it mean when you say constantly changing? Is it weekly, monthly, quarterly, daily, whatever? Once you define that, tell me why you think it changes as much as it does in your particular environment.
Well, for me, constantly changing means, you know, weekly or daily. And it changes that much because there are so many people who can give feedback on a UI. Much more so than something that's code-based. You know, that guy over in marketing gets a look at it, and he has some ideas, and project management wants to put this in, and that guy over there has some ideas. So they have this influx of input, and they're just constantly trying to keep up with everybody's comments, I think.
Well, there are a lot of meetings that go on between the developers and the clients, and this stuff does change usually daily and sometimes weekly. And you know, keep up with it, continually open it up. And this is provided that, you know, you have actually been informed that the project is happening. Because occasionally it's, you know, hey, are you documenting this? And you're like, yeah, sure I am. And then you have to go quickly find out what it is, where it is, and have you actually been given permissions to it? Then it gets interesting.
Yeah, I've often run into that kind of a problem as well, where if you were working in a software environment where you're customizing something for various clients, and you know, making sure that you have the permissions to look and see what's being done for that particular client can be a rather challenging part of it, because if, you know, depending on how much they're paying you or your company rather, you know, they may be expecting things on a pretty rapid turnaround. And if you don't know it, there's not a thing you can do except try and pedal faster and catch up.
I get the rapid turnaround thing. We recently landed a new client whose name escapes me, and I'm probably not allowed to say even if I remembered it. But all of a sudden, now we have a bunch of things due in October, and the developers know about it, and they're programming things. And I figured that probably a week before it's actually due, they'll say, oh, how about the documentation? And right now I'm actually doing software testing for them, and I haven't been doing as much on the documentation front. And then I'll suddenly get to switch gears and go back to documentation and say, oh, now where is this again? You know, do I actually have access to it and stuff like that?
So, as the technical writers in the group here, first question is, do you feel that you're always in the loop when the developers are working? Or if you're out of the loop, which word on the street says you're not always in the loop, why? Well, what happens? Why are you always sort of left out of this? Jackie, what do you think?
I don't think most development teams see, or companies really, see documentation as part of the product. They see it as an add-on, a piece of support maybe. And they don't see tech writers as user advocates, which I think is a vital role. If we can instead represent the user in the design meetings, make those good changes really early on, help them develop that sense of what the user really needs here, then I think we get invited into the loop a lot earlier. And they don't think of us at the last minute, you know, a week before the product goes out and says, hey, have you documented it? Because they've spent, you know, 2 months talking to you about how it should be done. So if you can really get in there early and be the user advocate, I think it changes the whole ballgame.
I think that technical writing is valued up to a point, but it simply isn't a priority. With the user guides and so forth, it's something that they need to provide to the user, but the first step is to, you know, get the UI into some sort of shape, beta shape, to ship out to the client so they can start testing it. And then once they're ready to actually give it to the client, then it's like, oh, by the way, we need that documentation tomorrow. So
tomorrow,
it has happened, and then I get to have my heart attack and say, "Okay, you know, first, when do you need it, and when did they ask for it?" Because sometimes they assume that you actually know this stuff, and I'm not in those development meetings. I'm the fly on the wall, and I have to actually ask the questions and say, "Oh, by the way, you mentioned this module you were writing some time ago. How's that coming?" Because you're almost expected to keep yourself informed and in the loop. So, yeah, it is valued to a point, but it's just not one of their priorities until, oh, where's the manual? And then it's basically your priority.
Yeah, I find that in my experience, I've sort of been in places similar to both Jackie and Craig in that, where I did have the opportunity to be in at the beginning, to play the user advocate role, it was because there was no BA. So I did some business analysis stuff, which sort of started driving, you know, what is it that these users really need to do? And that kind of launched my interest in usability and user interface design. But I also think that, you know, it's one of those things where initially I think it's still true that tech writers often have to be extremely proactive and balance being polite with being a nuisance in order to get in on the development meetings, to understand what's happening, to make sure that, you know, their deliverables are included in the project plan and that sort of thing, so that they can play that role of user's advocate and really have some influence on how that user interface is going to work.
So what are some ways that technical communicators, while you're on the team, can get yourselves into those meetings? What are some, you know, these are the bonus tips, right? So you can say, you know what, bring me into this, or you can get confidence quickly.
I would basically try to ask. We have a fairly well-defined command structure for a flat organization, and I would ask my manager and just say, do I need to be in this? He's pretty good at defining time, and your time is most efficiently used here. And sometimes he'll say, you need to sit in on this because this thing is getting ready and it's getting hot. It's a hot potato. And so I stay in contact with my manager and my other technical contacts to just see what is going on where and who knows what. So a lot of stopping by cubicles, somewhat less on the email front because everybody gets loads of email. So I might pick up the phone or I stop by in person and ask them.
I'm afraid I was a little scarier in my way of going about this. I actually haunted the people doing the front end, so the mock-ups, the actual design of the UI, so that I could, because they were always invited to the development meetings, but I wasn't necessarily. So I would haunt them and sometimes track them down to their meetings and say, oh, here you are, and just come into the meeting. Yeah, you got to do what you got to do, right? You got to be in those meetings. So, yeah, if you got to follow people around like you're crazy, then do it.
Sometimes you just get really lucky and you actually report to the development manager. I think where I was the most involved in UI, I was reporting to the development manager. He hired me. It wasn't somebody else saying, oh, you need a tech writer, hire this person. He interviewed me. He sort of got it, whereas a lot of times they don't. And so I was able to find out early what was happening because he would just ask me if I thought I needed to know. And then I could ask questions about, well, how about if I help you with this, or can I suggest that, or what do I need to do to get into the defect tracking system so I can see, you know, what people are finding. And so all of a sudden it wasn't, oh, you know, we got to turn this over to the tech writer a couple weeks before we're ready for release. All of a sudden it was, oh, here's an invitation to the weekly status meeting on what's happening on the development front. But I think that it pays to push, but you also have to know your environment well enough to know how far you can push it and what's the best way to do that.
Hey, Connie, you mentioned the a bug tracking system. I was using the same thing to sneakily track what the development team was actually completing, so I could see when they would commit code. and say, all right, that's ready for me to go and take a look at now. Fantastic. So, yeah, good tool.
Yeah.
So stealthily going, you won't put the screws to me. I'm going to get you. I already know what you've committed.
Nice. Yeah, and it also pays that when you see something that isn't, you know, because we tend to be the ones, we tend to be user advocates, because most of us go in and play with the system like a user would. Oh, yeah. And I have found all kinds of show-stopping bugs over the course of my career as a result of that. And, you know, you do that a few times and all of a sudden they stop looking at you like you're the one taking minutes at the meeting, and they start looking at you like, oh, this person actually knows something about what we're trying to do here. And it's a game changer. And it's really, it's the kind of thing, it can take a while. You have to have a lot of patience. But when it happens, it's like very, very satisfying to be a part of a team like that.
Now, Connie, they told me I was breaking the product when I was doing that sort of stuff. So they actually got kind of exasperated with me. But, you know, it's a double-edged sword, right?
Yeah. Well, they wanted me to break it. Because they figured if I couldn't break it, then it was, you know, that at the you know, once it went out into actual production live use, they'd get fewer calls, because we had broken all the things that could possibly be broken, and you know, therefore, you know, we fixed them all before it went out.
That's a good team, because they're forward thinking. That's great.
The interesting thing about breaking stuff is I actually did. I brought down a production database. Our big production day is Friday. And I brought one down Friday morning. And I didn't realize it because I was plugging in something. I was doing software testing without being the software tester. And I heard from everybody, from my manager, the top people in production, and the guy who runs the place, who basically asked me, you know, what did I think I was doing? Now,
oh, they didn't thank you. They didn't say, hey, Craig, that's fantastic.
No, ma'am, they did not. And I was petrified all day because they weren't angry with me. They were angry at the situation, mm-hmm. because I thought there should have been some internal guards on this. And they're like, well, we know how to work it. So that was sort of, I was caught like right in the middle there. And now, because in addition to technical writing, they said, well, you're now a software tester. Now I'm encouraged to break things.
I was wondering how you got
fun. I think they were just like short on guys, so they said, oh, you're not going to test software. And already I'm seeing places where I can improve the documentation.
Great.
So I know about breaking things.
I always like testing. Yeah, testing was fun, right? So you get to like, ooh, what happens if we all three ask for this at the same time? You know?
I like testing. I've discovered that I do like it. And I actually asked up on Tech World, do you think, you know, a technical writer can actually do this stuff? And everybody was very encouraging. So mm-hmm. I've been enjoying it.
I find it's really, really interesting, because one of the things that happens, in addition to knowing what's going to be worked on because you found what broke, it also gives you a lot of insight into how your developers minds work, you know? So when you're getting ready for the next product or the next release, you have a better sense of how this team is going to work together. And I think over the long term, that can be nothing but help to trying to make sure that you can get all of this stuff documented the way it needs to be.
I like the testing bit, because there's actually a testing team and I'm on the testing team. Whereas when you're a technical writer, you're kind of in the outfield, at least where I am.
You are.
And you're the guy who's, well, you're useful, but we don't know what else to do with you. And now I'm on this three guy team, and all of a sudden, you know, you've actually got buddies with you instead of me trying to write something all by myself. You know, and
you're
now
such a lonely writer.
I was the first guy they hired as a technical writer, and I'm still like the only guy there who does it. I have all the manuals on my desktop. They're now on the network now, of course. But yeah, for a long time, they didn't really know, my boss did, of course, but the rest of the company really didn't know who I was or what I was doing there. It's like, oh, you can spell, right? It's like, well, yes, I also write stuff. But now that I'm testing, it's like, oh, he can test too. And it's like, well, yes. So my cachet is actually rising. I think in this atmosphere that it's good to be a software tester because my star is actually rising and you're actually part of a, real team instead of, just being the technical writer scribbling away in a corner somewhere.
That is so sad, Craig.
It's like, Craig, what exactly do you do around here?
Because if somebody...
He has a red stapler on his desk.
Yeah, right.
Actually, Connie, I have a red stapler on my home office. It's the old swing line red stapler. It was weird when I first got there because I knew I was doing the user guides. No one else did. When I said, oh, the user guides, they go, oh. And that would be kind of it because I think for a lot of people, writing is almost kind of painful and they don't really like to do it, especially when they have to do it precisely. They can scribble out a grocery list, but they can't exactly scribble down procedures. And when you're actually doing the testing in which you still use analytical processes, you're like actually helping more of the company out. Instead of just producing something that no one's going to read, now it's like, oh, you're helping out all the software, you're helping the developers and the programmers. And now when I say, oh, well, I do testing too, it's like, oh, and there's actually genuine interest, which is very cool.
It's it's fascinating to me to hear that some things are, are pretty universal and some things are somewhat unique to our different situations. I'd be curious to find out, and you may not really be as familiar with whatever development methodology your team is using, but do you think how the developers interact with technical writers or non-developers of any kind on the team has changed as, new development methodologies like Agile and Extreme Programming have come along?
Well, I've been in the Agile development a couple of times, and it's interesting. I gotta say, I've never seen anybody do it right, because I took some training on Agile, and then saw the development teams using it all wrong. So it gives you more access to them as long as you're invited to these Agile meetings. But there's sort of Agile meetings that are supposed to be stand up 15 minutes. Everybody gives their, here's what we're going to do today. Here's our focus. Okay, everybody break. And it turns into, an hour-long meeting about bugs and problems they're having. back in their cubicles, and you're sitting there wasting your time thinking, this is not Agile. So you do have more access with the newer methodologies, I think, and especially if you tend to bring muffins or cookies, they will invite you regularly. it's not always great, in my opinion.
Yes. The muffins and the cookies used to work. However, in my place, most everybody's on a diet, and they're like, "Well, my doctor won't let me eat that." And I just leave. Yeah, I'd have to start bringing fresh fruit or something.
So our tech whirler top tip is: if you want to invite it to meetings, bring snacks. And the second one is, and it's good to learn these things. So if by some chance your Canadian friends use the word, it's interesting. That really means, man, not good. In the South, it's like, oh, bless their heart. They invited me, and then they like screwed around and like wasted all my time for an hour. So it's good. These are tips you just can't pick up anywhere else.
That's true. It's true. It's funny how the whole bring food and they will answer your questions just is never changed. We have talked about it ever since I've been a part of the list, that sometimes that's the only solution to getting developers, project managers, testers, whoever else is on your team that you need to talk to you is to actually bribe them with some sort of food. And it just is, it never ceases to amaze me that it's still that way 20 years later.
I think smokes would work. I think all the developers I know actually smoke.
Ooh,
so if I actually got a carton of cigarettes and hauled that into a meeting, I think I'd be a winner there.
Craig, you're verging on like prison life there.
I was saying, like, hey man, I'll give you a pack of smokes if you let me know when the UI's about to change.
You know, during break times, you can see the developers outside, and they've all got cigarettes, and they'll huddle in these, you know, little groups and stuff.
Those are their agile meetings, Craig. You gotta get into them.
I know that some of the developers do use stuff like that. Because I've heard them mention the words, but the smokes will get them.
That's funny. Bribery still works, in other words.
You have to figure out the right kind of bribe, because if they're all like overweight and on diets, sweets won't work. Sweets work at the front desk, but if you want to get to the hardcore programmers, you got to give them coffee and cigarettes. That's pretty much it. And there's free coffee in the cafeteria, so you'd have to bring in, you know, something from outside that's really exotic.
Hey, man, I got some fresh bean and a, you know, pack of Marlboros in the back.
That's right.
You know?
I think a trunk full of cigarettes would work.
Man. I'm seeing our new sitcom. You know, I'm seeing.
We should just call it Trunk Full of Cigarettes.
There you go. Oh, my. Well, it sort of does, you know, it leads into one of my next thoughts, is that trying to figure out who are the right people on a team that you need to contact in advance on a regular basis to find out what the changes are that are coming down the pike. Who do you guys think are the key people that you should always have the ear of? When you're on a new project?
Probably my manager, I guess, because he's the one who's in charge of most of the developers. And if I go into one of the developers and say, well, when is this due? What do you think I should know? And when do you think I need to know it? Basically, they're all he. So I'll just say, he would say, talk to, you know, Srinath. And I would say, okay, I'll go ask him. And basically, I stay in contact with my manager. If it's important, I just go in and talk to him. Of course, it's difficult now since we're all working from home after the flood. But basically, I would call him because he says he just doesn't really read, you know, email that much, because he gets a ton of it from everybody. You have to pick up the phone and call your manager or call a developer.
So, Craig, my experience is completely opposite to yours. I was the one informing my manager of things to come. Unless it was something coming really down from the VPs or something that filtered through my manager, to keep on track of things, I would have to go and talk to the development lead for the project and possibly at the same time, the QA lead for the project, because they were the guys who really knew what was going to happen when. They were in charge of timelines, internal timelines, and they knew what all the team members were doing. QA was particularly important because they had kind of the same deadlines that we're working to, where development's, you know, a week or two ahead or behind, however you like to see it. QA was pretty much on the same timeline as we are. So waiting for things to come through and get finished, QA was a great resource. Lots of donuts.
Yes. I worked in one environment where the major Krispy Kreme bakery for that particular city was half a mile from our office, and it was amazing how much money you could make by going around saying, give me a dollar, I'm going for donuts. It was great. You know, you could actually make your gas money. It was great. So anyway, be that as it may,
can't give you any money for donuts. I'm saving it all for cigarettes. I know there's a major release coming up. I gotta save it.
And whatever your caffeine of choice is, we went through a lot of Jolt Cola in those days. Anyway, one of the things that it does point out to me is that, where one of the things that I see in my experience, and I've been doing this for 17 or 18 years now, is that it's really key to be thinking on two different perspectives, I guess. One is that this is my project for documentation. How do I plan all of the pieces that are going to be put in there? What are my review cycles? You know, how do I decide what's the best way to present this document? All of those kinds of things that go into a documentation plan. But at the same time, the importance of making sure that that is integrated into the overall project. And that's where I found as time has gone on, it's become more and more important to me to be a part of, you know, to also have the ear of the project manager to find out from their perspective. It also helps you to sort of get an idea of how much scope creep there really is and going to be in your project. As time has gone on, and maybe it's because of the increased popularity of PMBOK and stuff, that more and more often I find that the project managers are starting to be a part or to include major documentation milestones within the overall project plan. And to me, that's one of the best changes that could happen, because at least you can make sure that you've got a sense of where the overall project is heading, and then from there be able to figure out, okay, I can talk to the lead developer about this, but I got to check with the QA person over here, and really be able to keep up your schedule of things that you've got to be following up on and checking with and that sort of thing. So I think that is one of the things that I've seen is a good change that has come out over the last few years, of as more and more teams are trying to follow some sort of project management methodology, you are more likely to have your deadlines included than it used to be. So that kind of leads me to, we want to try and get into a little bit of some of these everyday challenges of how do I make this happen? You know, I've got this project. I kind of know what the general deliverables are, milestones are for it, but what's the nitty gritty of making sure that I can stay on top of how the UI is changing?
One of the things that I do, since I'm never exactly sure when something is going to drop, it might be a month and then it might be moved up to next week, is I think that documenting function by function is falling out of favor, but that's usually what I wind up doing. It's like, what are the big five things that I need to hit that a client who's tired and frustrated at 2 a.m. trying to work this thing is going to want? How do I open up a project? How do I save it? How do I get the thing moving? And I will try for almost like a quick reference guide type of thing to start off with. And if I can't make it work right away, then I'll go talk to a developer and say, oh, by the way, I was unable to open up a project. What am I missing here? Or one of the big menu items, because that's what the clients are going to aim for, is like, how do I open this? How do I start that? How do I get here? And act like a dumb client, which is pretty easy for me. And that's how I do it, to get something on paper and ready to go.
So you kind of take the approach of, when you're planning out how you're going to document something, you prioritize most key functions and do those first?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. That's how I aim for it, because that's how I figure, as soon as we opened up Skype, I'm looking at the menu things, and even though I didn't find what I wanted right away, I thought, okay, what's really important here is, okay, let's be able to do the instant message thing, and that's how I would get around with a UI, is say, what's the top three or the top five, and as I get on, like, what's the top 10, and stuff like that, and just try to get them down bang, 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 so that the client sees right away, okay, these are the different options available in the menu, and try to lead them by the hand.
So I was there about 3-4 years ago, where, yeah, if I was hitting the major functions, then I was happy. I hit them all by the end of, you know, by the time it's ready to release, fantastic. QA is in particular very, very happy, because to them, it looks like complete documentation. But once we got to the point where our documentation was a little more sophisticated and we started thinking more about the users, we realized documenting function by function was leaving a bunch of gaps. where if somebody was, for example, a new user, they'd have to come in and set, say, 20 to 30 things to get things working for a particular goal that they've got. But that was never documented. You could document each one individually, sure, and they could follow that through, but they don't know which things to set for which goal that they have. So there was this huge gap in documentation where users were really, really frustrated because they never got the answers they needed. Yes, they could find particular information about how to create a VM, how to have it start. But what they want is a whole set of options that they need to set and how to do that, and all in one place. So they don't have to read the entire documentation. And then, you know, that's the perfect documentation for them. It's geared towards them. It has their goal in mind, and it tells them what to do.
I have found that while doing the function by function approach ensures that you get everything, you got the time, and how often do we really have that? But if you have the time and the ability to do it, you want to be able to cross-reference the two approaches. I want to be able to put together documentation by role. I'm an AP clerk, and I need to know how to do these seven things in order to do my job. The rest of it doesn't matter to me. And once I know that kind of information, I have a good idea about where they're likely to come into the system looking for help. So I like to make sure that from a planning perspective, I know all of the functions and generally what they do, but that I'm also looking towards what are the key things that the major user groups are going to need to know how to do so that I can put together a topical sequence that makes sense for them, and then, you know, do all my linking and various other things that you can do in a help authoring tool to make sure that they're all of the other information is available to them should they decide they need it.
Usually I find that the quick and dirty thing is unfortunately the best way to go for where I am at right now with the functionality, because I don't know who is going to pick it up or what role they may have. And I haven't gotten any arguments yet, like we need to expand the documentation here or there. Sometimes there's a module addition. But basically, yeah, I hit the high points and get out. And then down the pike, I work on expanding it. If I, you know, hear something coming into the support desk, okay, this client's having trouble with this, you know, then I'll work on enhancing things.
Do you think that's because that your client user base is used to seeing their documentation in more of the function by function approach?
I'm not quite sure about that because I don't normally have contact with the clients, but I figure if there was something wrong with it or if somebody didn't like a portion of it, that they certainly know where to find me.
Craig, do you have a way for users to give you direct feedback on a particular piece of information, or does it all go through support?
Pretty much all goes through support. I started putting some basic contact information on there.
Yeah.
But basically support gets it. And I recently asked them, I said, if you hear something about like the documentation, like I can't find this or this doesn't work for me, to let me know about it. And
yeah, the thing about users is that they'll only complain when they're really, really annoyed. Oh, yeah. They're just mildly annoyed.
Right.
You're never going to hear about it.
And even being really, really annoyed would be feedback of a kind, because then I would know, okay, this is drastically wrong and I need to fix it.
Yeah, but usually that's error-based rather than just the type
Correct.
Of documentation you're writing. So
Correct.
I think one of the real gaps, two real gaps you mentioned, lack of contact with your users. So you really don't know them. You don't know their goals. And it's a struggle, I think, every place I've been as a technical writer, getting that access to the user. But it's vital to writing documentation that's really geared directly towards them, in my opinion.
Correct.
The other thing is, what was the other thing? You know what? I lost it.
Well, the whole thing about working in isolation is, you do the best you can with the information you have, and sometimes you have zero information. You don't know who's
yeah.
going to pick it up
yeah.
from a new user to an experienced user. And that's why I call myself a duct tape technical writer, because I bang it together and I ship. And
yeah.
if somebody's really, really upset, I'll find out about it. A coworker of mine says, no news is good news. And they basically know where to find me. And I have yet to, knock wood, hear anything really, really nasty.
So I think the other thing that I forgot, now I've remembered, is that, You know, on some Microsoft products and also on Windows on their support pages, there's that little widget at the bottom that gives you the ability, the user, the ability to give direct feedback about a particular topic. So if you're just mildly annoyed, you can be like, yeah, let me give this a poor rating and send them a quick comment. I think that's invaluable for us tech writers to get those low level, I'm just frustrated, this isn't really an error, but I wish they would improve this sort of feedback.
I think that's probably for web-based documentation,
yeah, yeah,
correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, my primary output is PDF. That's what people want, because our sales guys can throw it into their briefcase,
yeah,
mark
okay.
it up, post-it note it, and they don't need power to do anything. And I do provide web stuff, but nobody asks for it. What the hot thing is PDF.
Interesting.
That's what I produce.
Luddites.
Careful. The paperless document format is one of our favorite things around here at Tech World. But I mentioned that this show is sponsored by Adobe. And
yay, Adobe. Yay. So, I mean, I would be all for feedback, because if a customer likes something, that's great. If they don't like something, you know, sock it to me, right? Between the eyes, both barrels. But there's no way I can contact them without going through support, and that kind of requires various levels of approval, and they're not really sure what I would say to them.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, just crank it out is basically what I do. So if I ever get a chance to do more than the PDF stuff, if somebody asks me for it, it's certainly available, but that's not what they want.
So I'm wondering if you all have recommendations for tools that help you kind of manage the workflow of your documentation development and revision kinds of processes. I mean, do you have something that integrates with the project management tool, or is there a wiki, or is there a SharePoint repository for project documentation, those kinds of things? What are the things that you all do in order to sort of manage that ongoing, how do I keep it up to date with what's happening in the UI process?
Lots of juggling. There's a lot of juggling, and I know we have a SharePoint something or other. I probably have access to it, but no one's told me about it yet. And basically what I do is when I realize that there's an update, I put it on the network. And then the people who might need it, I say, well, there's an updated PDF on the network share, and I will email people a copy. Primitive possibly, but that's the way I do it.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add to this one project management-wise. I mean, there were so many ways of finding out about changes. They never fell into, I mean, there was a wiki, there was SharePoint, there was the bug tracking system, there were the meetings, there was, that guy talking about something that I overheard in the cafeteria. Any project management tool, like we had a workflow sort of thing in our CMS, it was going to take more time to change the states and go through the process than it would have taken to update the documentation. No tool I've seen can keep up with it well as the human brain.
That does seem to be like, and if you can get into an environment where you've got some tools that are already relatively well accepted, then it's easier to do that. The contract that I work on right now, they have fairly sizable and robust implementation of SharePoint, and different project teams set up their repositories in different ways. Nobody really uses notifications the way they should, but at least you actually have access to one central repository where things are, and that helps a little bit. But I know that in looking at some of the tools like Adobe Technical Communications Suite or the Madcap Software Suite, that they do have like built-in reviewing workflow tools, and was wondering if you guys had any experience with that, and does it really help you to be able to manage at least your review cycle a little more formally?
I don't think there's anything really formal about the review cycle. It's pretty much, you know, hammer it out and make sure that people know where it is. And it's basically working like crazy.
Nothing different here. Even with a big team, the review process was, hey, you got something? Yeah, we got something. Here it is.
A lot of tossing the documentation around the room.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. We had automatically set up automatic publishing every evening, so they could always access the most recent documentation, even if you're in mid-sentence. So that was helpful from an automated standpoint. But managing the review, no. I mean, it was just part of the weekly status meetings.
Okay. So one of the other questions that I have that's sort of related to the nitty gritty of, you know, this happens at some stage in every project kind of thing, is there is usually a date planned for a code freeze. Now, frequently it shifts, as we've all heard from our various experiences. But when you're planning your documentation, do you want to freeze it at the same time as the code, or do you want to wait a particular time frame, or do you want to freeze it early in order to figure out, you know, this is the point that we're documenting, you know, and anything after that goes in release notes or in the next version or whatever. How do you guys handle that?
Well, the documentation never freezes. It's pretty much shifting ground all the time. yeah, occasionally I'll hear about a code freeze, but I'm not in that loop. And if something needs to be done, it just simply gets done. So the documentation is a warm, living thing at all times. Yeah, it lives and it breathes.
I got a different answer. We definitely had documentation freeze dates, but I'm going to give you two answers, because embedded help or field descriptions or whatever you want to call it had to be in with the code freeze. So you had to get even before their date to make sure you can get people to review it so they can all be updated. And so you were actually trying to beat them to it with embedded help. With regular documentation or the rest of the documentation, I wanted and usually got about 2 weeks. And I used that 2 weeks to do a review of my own content after code freeze. And I said, you know what? I need these 2 weeks. QA can also review it during this time, but I don't guarantee it's correct because I'm doing my review right now. Because they were changing things up to the very last second, and sometimes after that. So you had to give me that 2 weeks to say, all right, I'm going to go back through everything that, you know, four people have written and make sure it's right. If you guys change anything, you need now to go through a change request process. You guys froze it. So that was our thing. 2 weeks was a good window, more if we could get it, but we couldn't usually. So yeah, 2 weeks.
Interesting. Okay.
Very nice. So no code freeze ever versus what seems to be a very prolonged sort of process, making certain everything comes together. Very nice. Very nice. So cigarettes and sort of out in the playground.
It's very, very, very active environment.
Shanking people. You know. They say the job's boring, huh? You know,
I wouldn't call it boring. There's always something going on.
Yeah, I'll take a pack of smokes and some of those Fritos you got in on the last truck.
Exactly.
Now we're going to transition. So we've been talking about this, and it's sort of been a free-flowing conversation, and I think it's pretty well. But now it's time for the tips and tricks. So we have three different perspectives here, or like two perspectives, and then Connie's got some of the general stuff from her experience. And anybody want to take the first tip or trick, either from working by yourself or working in large teams? Anyone? Anyone?
I'll do it. Me.
Okay. Yeah. You.
Okay.
Maybe
you ready?
Jackie,
you in the giant hat really and the red coat. Yeah.
Is everybody listening? This is a really good. Okay. Listen. Okay. Here it is. Tip number one: a good UI shouldn't need any documentation. All right, figure out how much you can input during the design phase and by providing embedded help. And get rid of the documentation. I mean, if it's a good GUI, they don't need it. They really don't. And they'll never look at it because the GUI's really awesome. But what the gotcha on that one is that you have to stick to the development schedule and even sometimes beat it. So that's a tricky one. Okay. That's my number one.
Excellent.
Shirking your responsibility. So what you're saying, just throw it all onto the UI design guys. Nothing on our side. Excellent. I like it, huh?
No, but we can help with the UI design. Okay. Absolutely. Oh, cool. User advocate.
So what's number two?
All right. Number two. If you do need to document the UI, meaning it's not the greatest thing in the world and the users do need documentation, try not to document the functionality. Try to document the user goals. And as Connie said, good point, you also sometimes have to make sure all the pieces of functionality are documented so they can look them up. But, you know, bottom line is be a user advocate. Number three, I actually have four, but I think I'll only talk about three. Number three, when working on a team where UI documentation could show up in any number of deliverables. So you're single sourcing the heck out of all your stuff. Make sure you do it smart. Plan it. If you're using Ditta, use Conref, content references. So you're only changing one little line when they change the entire UI. You can seem like a magician by single sourcing as much as you can.
Excellent.
And Greg, how about you? What do you have?
Let's see. My top three. I always ask for, what's the deliverable, which in my case is usually a PDF. I always ask what the deadline is, because sometimes they'll say we need a user guide, but they either don't know what the deadline is or it's been buried in an email somewhere. And I say, well, let's get a deadline set. And I always ask for who's the point of contact, because sometimes it'll shift and one developer will give it to another developer. So it's what's the deliverable, what's the deadline, who's my point of contact? And then I've got it all wrapped up pretty much, except for actually doing it.
Okay. Good hard edges.
Yeah, it's banging it out is what it is.
Yep, and it still happens in probably the majority of software development environments. A lot of it ends up slipping to that level of, we just got to get it out the door kind of thing. I would say my top three have more to do with planning for things ahead of time, so that when, you are in the thick of it's changing every day or every hour, you can sort of maintain some sense of sanity about it. First off, get to know who the lead developer, whoever's handling the project management duties and whoever's handling the QA duties, because between those three people and you are the four that make sure that product goes out the door in a fashion that the users will be able to use it. Find out what their goals are, what their issues are, how often they meet with their teams, whatever the case may be. But, and work together to build a schedule that includes the deliverables and the milestones for all that in one place, so everybody understands how they all fit together. I would also say that it's really, really key to make sure that you, if you don't have it, get access to the defect tracking system. You need to know. And oftentimes, I have seen this many, many times, and as Craig has talked about, it's actually kind of enjoyable. Oftentimes, tech writers are testers, and you should know how that defect tracking system works, and keep up with what are the high priority things, because those are the things that are most likely to change before you go to code freeze. And I would also say that if you have the opportunity, be a part of developing the project documentation, the stuff for the development lifecycle, the scope documents, the requirement specifications, because especially when it comes to the requirement specifications, that tells you what that system is going to do. And that should directly lead to your user goals so that you can then be prepared for what the system should do. So if it doesn't do it the first few times around, at least you'll know where it ultimately it's going to be, it's going to end up, and be prepared for that.
And that means it's the end of the show. A special thank you to some of the folks from the Special Writers Unit, Jackie Samuels and Craig Cardaman, and the editor of Tech Writer Today, Connie Giordano. Our deepest gratitude to all of our sponsors, Adobe, Component One, Madcap, EC Software, Society for Technical Communications, and Vancouver Island University. Our next show, Halloween Tech Writer Horror Stories and the Biggest Lies Tech Writers Tell. And if we have time, maybe the news. Thanks so much.